From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, our weekly update of news and events from Central and South America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. Tony, give us the lay of the land as we glide into 2018.
Yeah, when you look at a kind of brief summary of events in the region, it looks as though it's like kind of business as usual in many ways for Latin America and the Caribbean.
Yep.
But my take is that I think that 2018 is going to be an even more difficult year for Latin America, and paradoxically not for Venezuela. Because then it seems to me that 2017 enabled Venezuela to kind of exorcise most of its political demons.
Yeah.
And that it's now, and commentators generally agree that there are good prospects for Nicolas Maduro to get reelected at the end of this year, so long as he can achieve some improvement in the Venezuelan economy. And it looks as though
They're positioned to that.
The oil price heading up, and even without the oil price heading up, the measures that Nicolas Maduro and his ministerial team are taking in Venezuela should do a lot to improve the sick conditions for ordinary people in Venezuela. So, but for the rest of the region, and the outlook is extremely uncertain, and it seems to me that the underlying dynamic there is that the regional elites have not assimilated the fact that the policies that they've advocated, you know, forever since the 1980s, really, neoliberal Washington consensus style, structural adjustment style policies, just don't work. Mm. Should we start with Argentina?
Yeah, but you know, before we say what does and doesn't work, we have to be clear on the terminology, because you know, if you're the 1% or the 10th of 1% or 100th of 1% sitting on top of the heap, and you institute some program that enhances your economic and political position inside the structures of political economy, just because it's terrible for everyone else doesn't mean that your program failed. Au contraire, it means program succeeded. So, you know, from that point of view, maybe we're talking about failing to deliver for, you know, a sufficient political constituency to maintain it. But it's a success for the people that instituted, because their program is looting, and they're doing that rather effectively in some of these places.
Yeah, my take on it all is from the point of view of the impoverished majority, another sense in which it fails is that the institutions that have been built up over the last 10, 15, 20 years can't resist the tensions that result from the policy failure from the point of view of the impoverished majority.
You know,
and so what?
Yeah, go ahead, sorry.
So if you look at Argentina, for example, what we're likely to see through 2018 is continuing abuse of the country's institutions. And Mauricio Macri's government has already engaged in more layoffs of people working in the public sector. Mm-hmm. And there are continuing protests on the various issues to do with, for example, the pensions issue and other related administrative issues to do with public policy that affect the living conditions of ordinary people.
It's that same architecture of austerity that, of course, produces a response that ended up leading to the last government that they had there in the first place. We've talked about how he really can't go anywhere but sort of, I was going to say, not back to the future, but forward to the past.
Right. Yeah, and that's absolutely clear. And they, I shouldn't have been surprised, but I was surprised the other day when I read that Argentina is now in negotiations with the IMF.
Come on.
Which is absolutely crazy. You know, and
let's
so
replay the whole epic.
Yeah, and Argentina is one of the wealthiest countries in the region. It's in negotiations with the IMF about how and what the IMF is prescribing is incredibly the same old structural adjustment medicine: more privatization, more opening up of the economy to it's even more open to, as you say, global investment looters than it has been over the last year under Macri.
Which means more looting, and which means more austerity, which means...
more debt. I mean, Argentina is going to issue yet more debt in order to fund Mauricio Macri's government program. Mm-hmm. And so, and then if you look at things from a human rights point of view, all the human rights organizations in Argentina are up in arms over Macri's policy and the judicial policy of being very lenient with historic torturers and murderers from the dictatorship.
Right.
Most of whom, a recent report discovered, most of whom are under house arrest. They're not even in jail. You know, and one of the most notorious criminals of the dictatorship has just been granted house arrest, and that's what led to this look at, well, you know, what is the judicial policy towards these heinous individuals and their crimes? And that's it. And they get treated extremely leniently, and look at the case of Milagro Sala, which is ongoing now. She'll soon be entering her third year of imprisonment, but she hasn't been sentenced to anything.
Right.
There's no judgment against her.
And the same thing they're doing with, you know, they're trying to do with Da Silva and that they, you know, with Cristina, Cristina de Kirchner, excuse me, the same thing that they do with their political opponent. You know, oh my God, we found a parking ticket. Well, maybe it's hers from 1998, 50 years, and plus you can't run for office.
Right. So yeah, and these ridiculous claims around the Amir terrorist bombing case, which we'll certainly hear more of in the next few weeks.
Right.
Which are a blatant attempt to disqualify Cristina from running in the next presidential election.
Which, by the way, let's be clear, she had nothing to do with the government when that happened.
Oh yeah, absolutely. What she's accused of is covering up the subsequent investigation by trying to negotiate with Iran, by trying to talk to Iran about what their version of the involvement of Iranian nationals in the case is, and it's classic. I mean, in the same way that the Lockerbie bombing had nothing to do with Libya, and that's been categorically demonstrated, but it was used as a pretext to attack the Libyan Jamahiriya government. And then in exactly the same way, and it's just one more example of a long-standing practice by the United States and its allies to abuse their own involvement in terrorist attacks and turn that against their latest target.
Well, you know, a better example, the September 11th, 2001 attacks on the United States.
Right.
The victims of that were barred from suing Saudi Arabia, the domicile of, it was like 15 of the 18 people involved or whatever. And clear ties had been established with government officials and such with the players involved. Somebody once misspelled Iraq, Iran, in third grade or something. And so even though the families couldn't sue the Saudis, who were responsible, somebody sued Iran for a couple billion dollars and won a judgment in the New York federal court.
Yeah, of course they did. And so anyway, and that motif of abuse of terrorist atrocities in order to attack geopolitical opponents is a long-standing practice of the United States and its allies.
Yep.
And going back to Argentina, looking at there's growing concern around the Argentinian government's human rights policies, they just promoted one of the officials most intimately involved in the disappearance and subsequent death of Santiago Maldonado,
right,
which we covered a lot last year.
One might say consequent death, actually. Yeah, right.
Yeah, consequent death. Right. Yeah. So look at Argentina, and it's difficult to see how Argentina is going to involve very serious unrest through 2018. And if you look, because of that mixture of a repressive elite trying to institute extremely anti-democratic, anti-humanitarian policies against the wishes of the majority, but they'll point to the fact that they did better than they usually do in last year's legislative elections.
Right.
But that supposed electoral triumph that they projected as, you know, a huge achievement for Mauricio Macri, and they didn't even win. They won just over 40% of the vote.
Right.
And the only reason that they did well, that they won so many seats as they did, is because, again, the opposition was divided.
Right.
And we can see that in reverse in Venezuela.
That's right. That's exactly what happens. Before we leave Argentina on this point, I just want to back up for 1 second, because as they engage again, another cycle of insanity with the World Bank and IMF and that whole architecture of God knows what, Macri's term began with him handing over more or less the last payment on the last round, when he decided to pay those vulture funds their money, handing Barack Obama, you know, a check for whatever it was, $12 billion or whatever, that they legally were not obligated to pay.
Right. Absolutely.
Go ahead.
So, yeah, things in Argentina are not going to be tranquil and stable through 2018, and that's true for so many countries in the region. And going back to Venezuela, what happened in Venezuela is that, and as Pablo Vivanco has written a really good article in English about giving a summary of events, bringing people up to speed on what the political situation is in Venezuela. Pablo Vivanco is the Telesur English editor. And he published an article, I think it was last week, and it's worth hunting out to get a good profile of how things currently stand in Venezuela. Now, what happened in Venezuela, when I say that it was the reverse of Argentina, I do not mean to imply that Nicolas Maduro didn't have majority support. He did. But the key thing about Venezuela is that the opposition is so divided that they're unable to put together a convincing, plausible, credible policy program,
right,
or to run an efficient election campaign. And so but even if they did unite, and their united vote, it was demonstrated on what was it, 3 electoral occasions last year?
Yeah.
The two
plebiscites, the one that was conducted by the opposition, the one by the government, and then earlier, the actual elections? Yeah, the actual elections later.
I was referring to the National Constituent Assembly on July the 30th.
Oh, so there are four.
The regional elections early in October. What was that, October the 15th? Something like that.
Yeah.
And then subsequently in December last month, the municipal elections, in which the opposition couldn't agree what their common policy was, and some parties participated and some didn't.
Right, so actually we have 5, because then you have those 2 plebiscites also.
And in all of those exercises, Nicolas Maduro demonstrated that he has a structural majority, a structural democratic electoral majority, capable of defeating the opposition, and the opposition have no they have no response to that. Now, as 2018 wears on, the oil price now is, what is it, around $60, a little over $60.
Yeah, I haven't looked since last week. I don't know.
So, that means that what I recall is that before the dramatic collapse in the oil price, when was it, 18 months, 2 years ago?
Yeah.
Something like that. The $60 was regarded as a good break-even point for Venezuela, that would enable them to maintain a healthy surplus from their main source of foreign exchange. Then Venezuela, when we start talking about Venezuela, it gets really complicated because there are much broader global geopolitical things going on in relation to Venezuela. For example, the petro yuan and the petrol oil transactions being carried out in non-dollar currencies, in particular Chinese yuan, and you end up talking about investment by Russian Federation companies, investment by China, huge investments by China.
By both. The ones from Russia also quite substantial that they've got on the boards that they're working out right now. You know, and there's some, you know, you got this geopolitical game that's going on around it. It's another area where really this a primary area, you know, going forward of economic warfare. The United States and Venezuela, of course, have been doing still a great deal of commerce in oil throughout pretty much everything that's going on since 1998. And, you know, they've been talking at least since November about that, you know, that's over or could be over.
Right.
So and now Russia and China are stepping up to the plate, basically saying, hey, let's do business. China, you know, we got factories. Let's drop Venezuela into the gas tank and crank out another billion cars. You know, they're really looking at some major economic projects together.
Yeah, and apart from those big economic projects, I mean, at a grassroots level, the Venezuelan authorities are devising new policies to empower small businesses, medium-sized businesses, cooperatives, and in many ways that I can't help thinking that they've looked at what's happened in Nicaragua, which has been very successful in developing a grassroots, inclusive, participatory economy,
mm-hmm.
especially from the point of view of women here in Nicaragua.
Yep.
And it looks as though Venezuela is taking some of the best elements of that model and applying it to their own economy. Let's see how successful they are. But whatever level of success they get, it's bound to diversify the domestic production of the Venezuelan economy and progressively reduce Venezuela's dependence. I mean, it's not going to happen in the short term, but in the medium term, it will definitely help to reduce Venezuela's dependence on its oil income.
Right.
So that's why I think that Venezuela, in strong contrast to Argentina, you're likely to see a dramatic stabilization in Venezuela, while in contrast to other countries like Argentina, but not just Argentina, in the rest of the region, another country where you're likely to see a consolidation of stability, if you like, is in Cuba, because in Cuba they've just had their elections. The National Assembly takes office. I'm not sure. It's sometime in April. I think it's the 27th of April, sometime towards the end of April. I can't remember the exact date.
Right.
But when they do, they'll elect a new president, and Raul Castro has already publicly stated that he will step down once the new National Assembly has elected the new president.
Right, so this is going to be a changing of the guard.
Yeah, a changing of the guard, and the most likely candidate is a guy called Miguel Díaz-Canel, who's a currently a vice president, one of the vice presidents in Cuba. And he's very well known here in Nicaragua because he attends virtually every celebration of the anniversary of the Nicaraguan Revolution on July 19th.
Yeah.
And he regularly makes some strong speeches in expressing Cuban policy in the region and Cuba's commitment to working closely with Nicaragua.
Right.
So, and I'd be very surprised if it's not Miguel Díaz-Canel that's elected in April. But and that's a strong sign of the stability that
that's
Cuba
right.
Enjoys,
yeah.
And that's currently being reflected in the fact that Federica Mogherini is currently visiting Cuba, and she's the essentially the European Union foreign minister.
Mm-hmm.
She's visiting Cuba, and she's publicly said over the last couple of days that the United States policy is illegal and obsolete
right.
towards Cuba.
Right.
And she's encouraging the United States to change its policy. Well, that's a very big deal in foreign policy terms, because
yeah,
it's another example among the few, but increasingly, there's this strong disagreement between the European Union and the United States. And so for the moment, it just extends to issues like, well, do we recognize Cuba? Do we work with Cuba or not? And the European Union has very clearly taken the decision to work with Cuba,
right.
Which is, you know, another slap in the face to the United States government's pathetic foreign policy failures. You know,
yeah.
And
more importantly, what it does is it allows Cuba to start engaging with, you know, a larger section of the global economy. And, you know, the sheer force of there are so many realities that are, you know, forcing themselves onto the stage in place of the hubris of the United States over, you know, the last, well, whatever, since 1776. But certainly since, you know, with Cuba policy, aside from we started out with the annual ritual at the United Nations where, you know, the whole of the 193 members or whatever it was at the given time, because this goes back a couple decades now, at the General
right.
Assembly in September or October, because they convened in September, they would have a vote and it would be, you know, the entire world says U.S. sanctions, bad, illegal, stop doing it, except the United States, sometimes Israel, sometimes either Palau or the Marshall Islands, and that was about it. And every once in a while they get a penguin in Antarctica to vote on it. And sometimes the penguin abstained.
Well, yeah, and something very similar happened which is quite relevant for Central America in particular, when the United Nations held a vote condemning the United States government decision to move their embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv
yeah.
to Jerusalem.
Yep.
And the U.S. suffered a humiliating defeat in the United yep. Nations on that issue.
And what's kind of hard for me to understand is, you know, I mean, I understand it from some other angles, looking at the various political activity that goes on, you know, the influences U.S. foreign policy. But the actual announcement was a nothing burger. The law was passed. The procedure established, you know, 20 some odd years ago, I think it was 1993, 1994, when the Congress said, we recognize Jerusalem as the capital and we're going to move the embassy there unless the president certifies every 6 months or every year, I forget what, that the national security of the United States mandates that we postpone implementation. And so they've been doing that ever since. That's been the law. The U.S. policy is that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, legally, that's the policy, and that the embassy is going to go there. And as Trump made the other announcement, he again signed the waiver. So what happened was actually nothing except for this press conference, basically. And yet it galvanized, you know, it's almost like it was done on purpose to galvanize this opposition. It's kind of like what I'm watching with Iran right now. You know, I saw Trump, well, first he has Nikki Haley say some of the most outrageous things at the United Nations that, you know, the whole world almost lines up again, even people that, you know, nations that have antagonisms towards Iran, regional or whatever, almost the entire world lining up saying, well, no, you can't have it like that. And in Galvin, you know, you went from having these, you know, few hundred kids with Molotov cocktails or whatever in the streets to, on one side, to like a million people in every city in Iran standing up for the government and for their, you know, for their political you know, construct. And so it's almost like he does this stuff on purpose.
Yeah, and who knows what the motivations are.
Who knows? And who cares, really? It doesn't matter, right? What's actually in motion? That's what we study anyway. What's happening? What's in motion? Yeah.
Yeah, so in that vote, and in very similar to the votes on the issue of Cuba,
yep,
and sanctions against Cuba, as you say, it was the Marshall Islands and Israel voting together, yeah, with the United States.
Right.
But they were joined by Honduras and Guatemala.
Right.
And Guatemala, under Jimmy Morales, who's doing everything he can to try and keep at bay the corruption investigations that did plague him all through 2017.
Right.
And it's very clear that this decision by his government to also move their embassy to Jerusalem is an attempt by Jimmy Morales to curry favor with the United States and stave off the judicial processes and investigations involving his corrupt administration.
Well, you know, he doesn't have the same prerogatives that the U.S. presidents have, like Bill Clinton or George Bush or whatever. When something goes wrong here and they start investigating him, they bomb someplace. You know, like
right.
Clinton, you've got the thing with Monica Lewinsky, let's bomb Iraq. You know, with Bush, we've got, and actually, they both, whenever something went wrong, seem to like to bomb Iraq. He can't bomb Iraq, so he's got to do this other stuff.
Right. And also Juan Orlando Hernandez in Honduras, his government supported the United States in that UN vote.
Yep.
Hardly a surprise, because he's also desperately struggling for his political life and he needs all the support that he can get now.
Yep.
And in Honduras,
you predicted that, by the way. You predicted that was going to happen.
Yeah. So in Honduras, Juan Orlando Hernandez is likely to take office, I think it's on the 27th of this month.
Yeah.
Salvador Nasralla and Manuel Zelaya, the leaders of the opposition alliance, have said that they're going to hold a rival inauguration.
Well, they actually did win the election. I mean, nobody's letting them take office. But as it turns out, they actually won the election, so they might as well at least have a party if they can't take office.
Right. So, and it hardly anybody disagree. Even the Organization of American States, whatever its motives may be, are saying that the election was deeply flawed and new elections should be held.
Yep.
And that the last time I looked at what the Organization of American States was saying, that was what they were saying. Whereas by contrast, the European Union was saying, well, you know, the vote was held, it was flawed, but that was the result. You know, so it's very strange that the European Union is actually taking a position even more supportive of Juan Orlando Hernandez than the Organization of American States. But from my point of view, my take on that is that what the Organization of American States is doing by taking this position is they're trying to protect themselves so that they have some credibility when they talk about Venezuela. And if they supported this outrageously fraudulent election result in Honduras, they nobody would take them seriously. Even fewer people would take them seriously than do already.
Ooh.
So, and that's, you know, I don't feel optimistic about the situation in Honduras, and that's another reason why I think that 2018 is going to be a very unstable year, that there's going to be greater instability across most of the region even than in 2017, because in 2017 corporate media were able to cover up the widespread instability in Latin America by focusing on Venezuela.
Yeah, and you know, they've been able to avoid covering the widespread problems around the world by focusing on crazy stuff here too, like Russiagate or whatever. And so we're out of time, and I want to pick up where we are now next week, because we have some more to update. Mexico, in some depth. Ecuador, of course, and what's happening there. Fujimori thing in Peru still cooking.
Right.
And so we'll talk again next week. And Tony, thank you so much.
Hey, thanks a million, John. Look forward to it.
Me too. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.